This is the November 16th, 2009 interview with Emory Herman. This is Jill Ferris speaking, and we are at Emory's house on 22 Mill Street. So, Emory, could you give us your full name and where you were born?
Full name, Emory Klein Herman, Jr., born in LaGrange, Georgia.
And what was it like growing up in Georgia?
It was warm. It was pleasant. I had a number of boys on my street that I enjoyed playing with. There were some colored boys on a nearby street that I also enjoyed playing with. Football, marbles, various games of tag, hide-and-go-seek, etc. I had two sisters. First one was just 2 years younger, and the second 6 years younger. And while I had various interactions with them, more like an older brother might tease rather than play kindly with them, they were an integral part of my childhood. And I stayed in Georgia until I was almost 13, I guess, 12 or 13, and at that time my father was in the Navy Medical Corps and was stationed in Pensacola, so we moved from my home in Georgia to Florida.
You mentioned that you played with some African-American boys on a different street. Did you go to school with them, or?
No. That schools were segregated at that point. This was after-school activities of one sort or another.
Did other children in the neighborhood play with the boys on the different street?
Oh, yeah. We had a swimming hole and a creek that wasn't very far away, maybe 5 minutes' walk, and we'd all be down there swimming and playing and swinging on vines and so forth.
So there wasn't pressure to segregate your friends?
There was a preference for my parents, particularly my mother and my grandparents, for me to play with some of the children of their friends, which I did, but it wasn't frowned on, or it was, at least it wasn't contraindicated in the sense of stopped. They did not come to our home. And we played on neutral ground, so to speak.
Okay. So you said that you had two sisters. Could you tell me a little bit more about your family?
Right. Well, my father was a solo practitioner as a surgeon and general physician. And he had been born in North Carolina and was the only one of the nine surviving children of his parents to move out of that state, but he came to LaGrange about 2 years after he finished medical school and had some training. And my mother was born in LaGrange, and her parents remained there. And then so it was my sister Anne, born in 31, and my sister Carolyn, born in 35, and I was born in 29.
All right. And are you still close with your sisters now?
Yeah.
Excellent. You earned a bachelor's degree from Emory in Atlanta, Georgia. How did you choose Emory University?
No smart choice in the sense of thinking it through. Like most young boys, I thought of going to University of North Carolina, where my father had gone. But in 45, the war was not fully over, Second World War, and gas rationing was such that Atlanta, being 60 or 70 miles away, was potentially much more sensible than going to Carolina, and I was a fairly young, I was 16 starting in college, so I think it was a choice that my mother made, and Emory was a fairly well-respected small college, and that was the choice.
Could you tell me about your time in college, maybe some of your favorite memories?
Yeah, I went there more or less thinking that I would try to get into medical school eventually, so that I was going to focus on some sciences. Now that I'm much older, I recognize that it might have been just as smart to focus on some non-hard sciences, but nevertheless I did. I had a very good friend from my hometown, Freeman Carey, who was transferring. He was 2 years or so older, but he was transferring from Georgia Tech to Emory to take a year to go into medical school there, and he and I became fast friends and have remained so. And so starting off in school with a roommate that I didn't dislike but didn't particularly find chummy, I hung around pretty much with Freeman, and we joined the same fraternity, and that was a place to eat and to make new friends. And after a couple of years, I became the treasurer of that fraternity and had that job. And I studied pretty hard. I was fairly young at the time, so that I wasn't exactly afraid of girls, but I was not anxious to get into the dating game in a big way. And I had a girl from my hometown that I was sweet on, so I had a fairly quiet weekend and studied and got along fairly well. Certain things I did better in than others, of course, but who didn't, right?
Did you see your girlfriend at home? Did you see the girl at home?
Yeah, when I went home, maybe once every 4 to 6 weeks, and we did share some letters. It was a very important, I think, time to get acquainted with the differences between boys and girls. And interestingly, about 3 years ago, after 50 years of no contact at all, I found out where she was, and she knew where I was, and we called, and Nancy and I went down and had luncheon with her. So it was fun to see her after 50 plus years or something like that.
Now, is this a girl from Pensacola?
No, a girl from LaGrange.
LaGrange. Mm-hmm. Can I actually go back and ask you, when you moved to Pensacola to be with mm-hmm. your father, were you living on a base or living off a base?
Off the base for about 2 years, I guess, and then on the base for the last part of his term down there, because he was the chief surgeon at the hospital. So we did live on the base briefly.
And what was that like to live on the base during...
During wartime?
Yeah.
You know, I was 14 or 15, and I'm not so sure that I recall it being different. There were some regular Navy people there who were higher ranked than my father, who was just in the Naval Reserve or was in the temporary Navy. So there was a little difference there in some of the experiences, because they had lived around the world, or at least around the States, and I was a country boy from Georgia. But it was easy enough.
Did your father join the Naval Reserve before World War II or prior to the war?
He took some correspondence courses to make his entry into the Navy a little more smooth, but I would guess probably he started in 39 or early 40, and then he went into the Navy, I think, in February of 41 or somewhere close to that. So it was at least 9 months before Pearl Harbor.
So, back to you. So you went to med school at Johns Hopkins. What made you decide to become a doctor?
Well, I saw the life that my father lived and the satisfaction that he had in what he was doing. And so I guess his father had been an old country doctor, and it was not something that I think was parentally urged on me, but I guess that I just gravitated toward that because it seemed like a profession that I would enjoy. And happily, I was right.
When you were starting med school, did you have an idea of a specialty that you wanted to go into?
No.
Okay.
I just wanted to pass and stay in medical school, which at the time was, and still is, an arduous 3 or 4 years. So thinking about beyond that, I was thinking of studying day by day and learning what I had to as it came along.
Do you have a sense of how med school education has changed or stayed the same?
Well, enormously changed, I think, and changing. I use books and pencils and paper. The computer is now that means of learning, thinking, and sharing. So that's a huge thing. Medicine used to be far less competitive. There was a sense of cordiality and maybe brotherhood even among doctors, which is not very evident now. Certainly some illnesses have changed. We don't hear about tuberculosis in the same sense. AIDS is totally new. Ideas about many illnesses, particularly cancer, that was not a word that was even used in polite society 60 years ago.
What was used instead?
Has a serious condition or has a real problem or something like that. Pregnancy would have been in my family not commonly used. She's going to have a baby, she's with child or something like that, but somebody being pregnant is suspicion to the fact she got that way in a poorly chosen manner. So society has changed, obviously, in many ways, even as medicine itself has changed. And the whole aspect of governmental regulation, which I'm in favor of in many, many ways, the business of insurance and second opinions and things of that sort, are not yet proven to be of real merit to me. But so those are the changes. And we had a small class, 70-odd students. I've kept up with almost all of them in a they're half gone now, but nevertheless kept up with them. And each of them that I know about really worked long and hard, and the idea of making money was less evident than the idea of being involved in something that you enjoyed and being of decent citizen and in some way serving the needs of the population that you lived in. Nowadays, rightly or wrongly, doctors consider their family and want family time and want vacations and want not to work 80 and 90 and 100 hour weeks, but that was just the de rigueur and when we were coming along.
So you ended up in Cooperstown following your residency. You said you kept up with most of the doctors. Did they stay in the area around Johns Hopkins?
Or? Oh, no, no, no. Johns Hopkins is internationally respected, and some went overseas, many went throughout the country, some went into the service. A good fraction of them, I would say, three quarters stayed on the eastern seaboard.
So you mentioned combining family and the medical profession. How did you manage to combine a family life and a practice?
Well, I had a very enterprising and industrious wife whom I met at Johns Hopkins. And when we fell in love, we both wanted the idea. She came up from a family of three, and so did I. We wanted a big family, so we said, let's have six. And I don't know where we drew that number, but we ended up having six children. The first child died right after birth. Although she worked the first 2 years of our marriage, because salaries at that time were about $20 a month. And there was no salary at Johns Hopkins, but we weren't married until after my internship year. So we were married for the 2 years that we spent in Atlanta. And then once I got into the service, I was in the public health service for 2 years in Bethesda. We were paid handsomely, something like $8,000 or $9,000 a year, which meant that we had some money left over even. So that she didn't have to work to support me after Atlanta days. And at that point, our children became primarily her responsibility. Not that I didn't enjoy them and feel blessed to have them, but I was busy with things at the hospital here in Cooperstown or elsewhere when I was in training, and she was made her D at home.
All right. How did you meet your first wife?
She was a nursing student at Hopkins, and I had my eye on her as she came along, and I came along, and we decided to take walks together, and had a good friend from Emory who had come there and had a car, and occasionally we'd even take a ride out in the country together, and it hit off pretty quickly. She was a very popular nurse and girl, and I had to do my own propaganda to win her over, but it worked.
What was your propaganda that you used?
Jill, I don't remember precisely, but it was I'm not as flashy as some of those guys, but you can count on me, one thing. Or I think that you can't explain the chemistry that works, and it seemed to work. And while there were at least two other guys who asked her to marry her, now, wait a minute, had to, you know, marry them, him, she waited for my request, and we decided to get married.
Excellent. Where were you married?
At her hometown in Springfield, Ohio, in August of 54.
And you mentioned being in the public health service in Bethesda. Could you describe the public health service?
Well, the public health service was a uniform service, although I never wore a uniform. I was at the National Heart Institute working in a chemistry laboratory part-time and working as a doctor on the heart wards other times. And I enjoyed a much less intense work schedule there than was the case when I was a resident in Atlanta. But these were guys who had been chosen sort of from the cream of the crop in other schools, so that there were some very bright young men and women there. And we lived on the campus of the National Institutes of Health. After staying there a few months, was able to get a home there. We liked it very much. We had a number of friends, kept up with some of them. They've been outstanding leaders in medicine, some. Mm-hmm.
So did you have a specialty then in the heart?
No, I didn't, truly. I had finished 3 general years, internship and 2 years of residency, and I had enjoyed blood diseases, particularly at Hopkins, and had kept up with the chief of hematology and had asked him if I couldn't take a fellowship there, which I did between 58 and 59. So I was hopeful all along of going into diseases of the blood and lymphatic system, and took a year of fellowship. And at that time, in I guess early 58, my father had a stroke, was severely limited, and I knew that I had to make some moves at that time, and the possibility which my wife liked best was to try to find a job somewhere in the South where she preferred to live. And so we made a trip to medical schools in Carolina and Georgia and Mississippi and Alabama, looking for a job where I might both teach and practice, because by that time there were 3 kids. No, there were 2, but one was on the way. And we didn't think we could manage on the low salaries that were paid then for full-time academic positions. But I was advised by some people very sternly and others gently that make up my mind, either go into academic medicine or go into practice, but don't try to mix the two, because that's not likely to work very well. So there came the opportunity to look at a job here in Cooperstown, a job which my chief at Johns Hopkins knew somebody here in Cooperstown, and they were looking for a person who had clinical skills and was interested in the possibility of research to come up here. So we looked at it, thought we'd be here for a couple of years at most, and it's now 50 years later.
So what kept you in Cooperstown?
Well, I was happy in my work. My wife had made a number of friends here. We adjusted to the weather with a few jokes here and there. I saw the possibility of becoming a general physician, as there were about four other general medical physicians here at the time, and thought that I would move from research, which I had been mostly responsible for when I first got here, and took a job as a general physician, and never looked back.
What drew you to a general practice?
Well, it was not general practice in the sense that I took care of everything. I didn't see children, I didn't do surgery, I didn't involve myself with pregnancy and so forth. But I did like the idea of a wide range of different disorders, and I just liked the involvement with people. So, in a sense, it was just following what my native urges and interests were.
Did you get to know people in town through your practice, or in other ways?
Cooperstown was small. Those in the hospital, there weren't, when I came here, more than 15 or 16 senior physicians, I think. I'd have to count them, but there weren't that many. The New York State Historical Association had perhaps six or seven persons of similar intellectual interests. And there were people generally in town that we met from either my wife's friends as she circulated, or from my practice for that matter. But Cooperstown was a most welcoming and cheerful place to be in. And I liked the young doctors, who were not that much younger than I was when I first started. We had friends who were coming here for medical training. And my son by that time was ready to go to school, so we met the parents of his classmates. And it wasn't long before I was chatty with many, many people. So I really thought it was easy. We had some work done on our homes by electricians, and I got to know them. We had our garbage picked up, and I knew the garbage collector. The policeman was somebody I met, so that it wasn't difficult, if you were open to this, to making new friends.
What was the town itself like when you first moved here?
It was different in the sense that although the population probably isn't changed more than 5%, it was somewhere around 2,500 at the time, as I recall. There were shoe stores, there were two drug stores, individually owned. There were about four grocery stores, barbershops, and it was not all baseball. So that's been a huge metamorphosis for Cooperstown. That would be